KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The crisis, if you will, is still out there, but our real estate here in Seattle is hot and moving up, and it's helping to relieve that.
3 or 4 years ago, we redoubled our efforts in terms of making it work.
When you look at it from the standpoint that it takes new dollars to support the program, that to me is what the definition of a Ponzi scheme is. Would we get in this program today if we were starting from scratch? Most legislators I talk to say no. You know, we should look at how we can get out of this thing in a thoughtful manner that minimizes our exposure.
Coming up today on The Big Show weekday, starting our midday with you, I'm Steve Scher. We have real estate expert Richard Hager. You heard him talking about Seattle's housing market. The market is recovering. Many of you are still underwater, and so if you have questions or problems, Richard Hager and Linda Thomas, real estate expert, are here to answer your housing questions. We also heard from Jerry Manning. He's the artistic director for the Seattle Repertory Theater, part of our Art of the City. Marcy Silman brings us a preview of their upcoming festival and talks about their dedication to new works. And that final voice was State Senator Rodney Thom talking about the Washington Guaranteed Education Tuition Program, better known as GET. We're starting the hour with that today. As you may have heard, Rodney Thom thinks GET is something like a Ponzi scheme, he said, and that we should get out of it in an orderly fashion. The state's higher education institutions say they would like to freeze tuition increases at current rates for the next 2 years or even more. In return, they would like the legislature to put more money into the system. Now, a new report from the state actuary says that locking in tuition at the state's public university for 2 years, freezing it, would actually put the state's guaranteed education program into pretty strong footing. Matt Smith is Washington State actuary. He's set to discuss GET funding in Olympia this morning. He joins us now. Matt Smith, I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. What prompted this, I guess, what we would call an actuary analysis of alternative tuition growth? Ed Murray requested this?
That's correct. One of the policy options the legislature is considering.
Now, in this report, you have two hypothetical scenarios. No tuition growth over the next 2 years, where state funding increases to approximately 40% over the two-year period to cover the inflationary costs of higher education. So that's if the legislature kicks in, what is it, an additional $200 million about?
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact dollar amounts, but right, that's the concept. Two scenarios where essentially tuition growth would be different than what we had expected.
And what would happen to the GET program if tuition growth under this first scenario, the 40% over 2 years?
Well, first, a little background. I mean, what we're doing here when we look at the health of the program is we compare the value of those GET contracts to the assets that we have on hand. That's the funded status. So that projection of future units is highly contingent upon what's going to happen to future tuition. So we make an assumption. So if the legislature were to adopt one of these scenarios with lower tuition growth, we would see an immediate improvement in the plan's funded status because the value of the obligations would be lower. So for the first scenario of holding tuition growth constant for the next 2 years, we would see an improvement in the funded status from 79% to 95%.
How is that historically? How has GET operated while it's been around?
Well, you know, the program has been around. I'm checking my notes here. The program has been around since, I believe, the mid-90s. Let me get the actual figure.
Yeah, I think that was right. 97, 98, wasn't it? Or 96, 97?
90. Well, we started. I have a history here. I think it was the mid-late 90s. But in terms of the funded status, one of the slides I'll show today is House Higher Ed Committee is a history of the plan's funded status. It has ranged from as high as 117% to about 79% now. And for most of the program's history, it has had a funded status above 100%. And it is when tuition has increased significantly above our assumptions is when the program has experienced some of these short-term funded status problems.
The other assumption, stated funding increases to 50% over 6 years. What happens to the get unit price then?
Well, that one's a little bit trickier because we're clearly making an assumption that that's going to occur. So that's over a six-year period would require future legislatures to also authorize that decision. So if you were to recognize that all today and assume that future legislatures would follow through on that commitment, the funded status would improve to 108%. In reality, what would probably happen is that we would monitor that and observe that and recognize that as legislatures adopted that policy. So it would probably happen in two-year chunks over a six-year period.
And what happens to the unfunded liability, this number that Rodney Tom and others who want to see get changed, what happens to that underfunded liability under these two different scenarios?
Yeah, very much correlated to those funded status numbers I just mentioned. So currently, using our current assumptions at June 30th, 2012, the program has a $631 million projected funding shortfall. And again, that's comparing the value of these future obligations to the assets that we have on hand.
Right. That's if everybody, including three-year-olds, were to cash in their get dollars at the same time.
Essentially. I mean, it's a way of measuring how the plan is doing in terms of its funding progress. So if the program were closed, that's the amount of money that you would need to put in today in order to honor all future obligations. That number decreases to $117 million under this no tuition growth for 2 years scenario and actually would become a surplus or reserve, is probably a better word, a reserve of $162 million under the scenario where state funding increases to 50% over the next 6 years.
And then under the current assumptions and your two different scenarios, what is the chance of state contribution over 50 years, and how do you calculate that? Because that's the rub of this, right? The state guarantees get if the money isn't there through the payment by the people who are part of the program.
That's correct. The participants have a contract with the state. That's why it's the guarantee and get, if you will. And it's designed to be a self-sustaining program, so no state contributions, entirely supported and financed by the people purchasing these contracts. So when we look at the risk of the state making contributions, we really are modeling a lot of different scenarios going forward, positive and negative economic growth, increases in tuition below what we expect, above what we expect, as well as below. So we're really trying to throw quite a few simulated futures at this program to see how it would weather both those positive and negative experiences. So under our current modeling, there is about a 1% chance over the next 50 years under the current program, current assumptions of the state needing to make a contribution over the next 50 years. That drops to about 0.2% if there's no tuition growth over the next 2 years. And it's virtually zero when you look at the scenario of increasing state funding to 50% over the next 6 years.
I see. I also noticed that the chance of a purchaser experiencing a negative return goes up with tuition growth being frozen. Why is that?
Yeah, that is something that we work with the GET committee. They are the body that adopts the unit price and monitors this program. One of the things they definitely want to monitor is this: managing the risk of this program is very much a balance. They would like to keep the chance of the state having to make a contribution very low. Ideally, they'd also like to keep the GET units as affordable as possible. So there's definitely some give and take there. So when they look at setting the price, they want to make sure that it's still a reasonable investment vehicle for future purchasers. So the chance of a future purchaser having a negative rate of return will increase when the purchase price increases and when the purchase price includes a recovery component. And that's currently what the program is doing to manage this current shortfall. There is a recovery premium, if you will, built into the unit price.
That's why it's at 100.
I'm clear.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's why the current GET unit price is 172 dollars a unit, and with no tuition growth, the projection is it would be, for 2 years, it would be $144 a unit. But you have a slight Correct. Increase in the number of sales under these different scenarios, too, but not a lot.
Right, becoming more affordable, but still including that recovery component. The current unit price has about a $20 charge in it that is part of this recovery plan, the plan to get the program back to 100% funded status. And that's when you see the impact on a purchaser. They may decide that this is not the investment that they want to make. I would say this program is currently priced is marketed towards someone who wants to save for college, has a long period of time to save for college, and is fairly risk-averse. He's not interested in investing in the stock market.
Matt Smith is the state actuary. He is looking at the GET program, and he'll be testifying about his analysis on alternative tuition growth before the state legislature a little later today. Betty Lochner runs the GET program, and I just wanted to play two clips from her in a conversation we had last week about GET and the complicated model that you do use to try to figure out how solvent the program is.
The bottom line is GET is a self-sustaining program. We get no money from general funds. It's all completely supported by participants' money and unit costs. So included in the unit cost is the cost of future tuition expenses based on what the assumptions are for long-term tuition, what the assumptions are for long-term investment returns, and what the assumptions are for how many people are going to buy units, how many units are going to be sold.
That's Betty Lochner. She was also, as head of the GET program, looking at some of the risks involved in the changing tuition scenarios.
The GET committee, the policy group that governs the program, that makes the policy decisions about the program, They decided to keep the program open and keep selling. Many, many states were closing programs because they were worried about the future liability and what to do. They decided to keep the program open. So all those people that continued buying units, even though they may have been underpriced for a few months, that money went in when the stock market was low. Then the stock market came back, the investments came back, and then we recovered those losses within 18 months. So it's a long-term investment program. There will be highs and there will be lows, but the model, as the way it's designed, and I think the actuaries' numbers demonstrate that, works as long as you can predict tuition. Now, tuition can be high, but it has to be predictable.
That's Betty Lochner, heads the GET program. We talked to her last week about the program. Also, State Senator Rodney Tom talked about the liability the program has incurred. Matt Smith is the state actuary. They're looking at the numbers he has put forth and now put out again as a way to try to understand the program. I wanted to play those, Matt, because I wanted to ask a question, and I know you are I don't want to ask a political question here. When you look at GET and other programs that are similar in nature, and perhaps even you could take Social Security as an example. How common is it to have programs that are self-funded, that rise and fall with the health of the economy, and do they put the state at risk?
I would say it's these types of these guaranteed programs. Their health certainly fluctuates with the rise and fall of the economy, and because they offer a guarantee, the person or the entity that guarantees that program is certainly going to carry a risk. It's the polar opposite, if you will, is to offer a program where you just invest monies towards future college expenses, and whatever you have in that account when your child is ready to go to college is what you have. So in that case, the individual family, the investor, is bearing all the risk. So it's a different policy choice. The state has currently decided to offer this guarantee to help families save for college, and they are also taking on that risk, and that's why the program requires careful and thoughtful analysis. That's why we do the projections that we do, to make sure that we understand that risk, and so that people can make informed decisions about whether or not it is an appropriate risk and whether or not that program should continue.
You know, one of the last charts you have in here is you changed the tuition growth rates from the current assumptions. And, of course, the current assumptions for tuition increases are double-digit, 10% for the next, well, 12% this year, 10% for the next 2 years, and then 8% in 2016, 5.5% afterwards. And then you have a no tuition growth for 2 years. And you have a chart for state funding increases over 50% over 6 years. I guess you were just sort of seeing which scenarios would play out, because not many of these scenarios are politically supported at this time. We don't know, but we haven't seen much talk about no tuition growth or state increasing funding to 50%. But that's your charge, is to just figure out these different assumptions?
Correct. I mean, the analysis that we've done here is scenario based. So that just means we were asked, if this particular path were to occur, what would happen? Does not mean that that is our best estimate. Doesn't mean that that's actually going to occur. It may, but it does inform the legislature how sensitive this program is to these types of policy decisions. We'll have to wait and see what happens through this legislative process. Yeah, I would agree. I don't think it's going to be easy to move additional funding into higher education, but that's really not my area or my concern. My charge is to let them know what might happen to the program under these types of scenarios, and we'll see what happens.
Yep, Matt, that is the politician's role. Matt Smith, I appreciate you talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Matt Smith is the state actuary for Washington State. He'll be testifying before the Senate a little later today to talk about some of the alternative tuition projections that he put forth as checking for GET's solvency and looking at alternative tuition growth. By the way, full disclosure, I am one of those many family members who invested in GET. And now I have kids in college enjoying the fruits of that. This is Weekday.
From money in education to money in the housing market, if you're thinking about buying or selling a home, we'll get some expert advice in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Years after you forget Super Bowl plays, you may well remember Super Bowl ads like these.
We shall prevail.
Off the billboard, through the window, off the wall, nothing but net.
What's that?
What's that?
I'm Steve Inskeep. The ads you'll be talking about on Monday on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Tiny's Organic Farm, committed to helping members fulfill their resolutions for a healthy new year by providing weekly organic fruit and vegetable delivery service throughout the greater Seattle area. Now serving Everett, Issaquah, Bellevue, Tacoma, and Puyallup. More at tinysorganic.com.
46 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Rain likely through the day with a predicted high of 50. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:22. A festival of new plays at Seattle Rep. KOW's Marcy Silman has more in 25 minutes.
The housing market, it seems to be coming back in this area. Construction has re-begun, I like that, has begun again, on developments around the area that maybe were delayed by the recession. But not everybody's in great shape, and maybe some of you are looking at getting a first mortgage or a refinancing and wondering about some of the letters that are pouring into your box. Maybe just have some questions about how to proceed. Well, Linda Taylor, who is housing director at the Urban League, she's here with us. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And Richard Hager, real estate agent and appraiser, fraud profiler. He's back with us again. Good to see you.
Morning.
And you are invited to give us a call. Maybe you have some very specific questions, and we would like to hear from you. 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email weekday at kuow.org. Do you feel at the Urban League, at your work at the Urban League, that you see a turn around in people's ability to stay in their homes, to push back on mortgages that may have been underwater? Is it better?
Yes, it is. It's getting better every day for those that seek assistance. We find that a lot of people that get denied is simple paperwork just simple paperwork. They're tired of sending in the paperwork, for starters, because the banks ask for this information over and over and over. And they just didn't fill out one box, or they just didn't get that budget just right. So professionals can help.
I know that we refinanced recently. Mm-hmm. I know that scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You forgot to check a box, and all of a sudden you're
done.
You're not. You got to start again, or you have to just sort of redo it.
And you have to start all over, because by this point your documents have expired. They don't have a current bank statement. They don't have. Or here's a biggie: you didn't send in all the pages of your bank statement. If it says 1 of 5, send that blank page that's number 5.
Now, is this because everybody is trying to cover themselves, or is everybody up the line being looked at with more scrutiny, or is this just...
Well, you got to remember the frontline person, the first person, you're not paying them as much, number one. And so they're doing the input. And if they can't go any further, they have to reject it.
I see.
That you shouldn't want them to make a decision on your loan.
They're following the rules now, and a lot of these people are poorly trained in foreign countries.
And, true.
Yes, and they'll have a checklist, and it's like, you must have these.
Our mortgages are being sent over. They're being outsourced to cheaper labor sources around the country.
And appraisals and appraisal reviews. How you do an appraisal from Pakistan, I haven't figured out, but I'll get phone calls from companies in Pakistan and India saying, we need you to do an appraisal, and it's for XYZ company or bank.
Ooh.
And so I tell them what I charge, and they go, oh, that's too much. We must go elsewhere. And so, we are getting it offshore a bit now.
Wow.
All right. Well, maybe you have some questions about your own appraisal, reappraisal, your mortgage, or maybe some of the letters coming to you. Richard Hager is a real estate agent and appraiser. Linda Taylor is housing director at the Urban League. Our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. Just what are some of those documents you have in front of you?
Well, there's when somebody goes into default, that's the foreclosure process, and they've missed their payment, the scammers, the whoever that's out there, because we're American, we come up with new systems all the time, they research county records, they figure out that you've missed a payment, and they'll send you an advertisement that, in this case here that I've got, is let us audit your loan. Let us look at your loan terms and your information, and we'll find problems, and you can go at the bank, and we'll force the bank to cut your loan in half or your interest rate down to 2%. Everyone that I have seen, it's a scam. It is an advertisement to people who are desperate because they're in default, missing their house payments. And these people are offering them very false hope of, we'll score the deal for you. We just need some money up front from you, $2,500, $3,500. Linda was telling me about $6,000 from somebody up front. So they recognize that these homeowners are in trouble, and they offer them a glimmer of hope. And homeowners by the thousands leap at it. And at the end of the day, they're just out more money.
If you have that kind of money, you should pay your mortgage.
Yeah, how often, how prevalent is this for you? When people come to talk to you and look for help, how many people are coming in saying, oh, I thought I did this other thing?
Well, a lot, an awful lot. I wouldn't say half, but probably about a quarter of them that admit it. And a lot of them don't admit it. They just come in and say, I've been trying to get a modification for a couple of years now. And then once we look into it, we know that we're not the first person to get an authorization. So that's how we know.
All right. I want to get some specifics in here. So here's Teresa in Renton. Teresa, you were looking at a modification of a home loan?
Yeah, I've got one. I just got it. It took me about a year and a half to get. And one of the things I wanted to mention, and I have a question all in one. What I learned when I went through this thing was it kind of, in my opinion, is a delayed foreclosure situation. What they do is they decrease your interest rate. They've got this waterfall. You'll know what I'm talking about. They decrease the interest rate. They stretch out the loan. They put this great big deferred principal way at the end. It's sitting out there, not gaining interest, or not. They're not charging you interest on it. But it seems like when and if I ever sell my home, I feel trapped because I'm going to owe this enormous balloon payment at the end. The bank never gave me a principal reduction. And, here's where the question comes. what's happened is you must quit making your payments for a long time. Otherwise, the bank won't even consider you because they don't think you need it. If you're not behind in your payments, well, it's pretty obvious you don't need it. But then your credit score goes way south. So how do I get around explaining to old people that want to sell me insurance? I was looking at new car insurance.
Wait, so your question, give me your question. I got a little lost.
How do I get around, how do I offset the enormous decrease in my credit history to make up for all the money that I'm going to, credit is tied to?
I see.
Time. Nothing cures your credit but time. Just start making all of your payments on time that you have with everything else, and your credit score will rise again.
Yeah, there's no magic bullet up front that you can do this. You borrowed the money. You signed documents that said, X right. is my mortgage amount.
This is how much I'll pay.
And this is how much you owe back to the banks.
And what about that big old balloon there?
She owes it. Some of that is the money that she didn't pay while she was in default.
Right. And again, I understand her frustration. The banks don't always tell you this up
right.
front.
And every bank and every loan or every investor doesn't do a principal reduction if you don't qualify for it.
I see.
So that waterfall that she's talking
mm-hmm,
about,
mm-hmm.
she stopped at the 2% at the reduction in interest rate.
I see. So out there there's a little dam out there.
Right. Yes.
Right. Right. And it delays. And again, is this money going to be owed at the end when she sells it? Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. How much she signed her promissory note for.
Now the good news is real estate values here start to heat up. They get a little better. It may resolve that issue. So at one point, the house will become worth more
right.
than the loan amount.
Exactly.
And there may be
happen.
A savings there.
That'll happen.
But
in
yeah.
time. And all of these loan modifications are designed for you to stay in your home, not sell it.
The bank wants you there.
Yes, they want you there making those payments. That's what the whole thing is designed for, to keep people in their homes. That's why they started out with people as their principal residence.
All right. I hope that helps you, Teresa. How about Christy at the UW? What are you looking at, Christy?
Yeah, so my husband and I bought a house a year ago with 10% down. And I read in the paper yesterday that home prices in Seattle have increased 10% over the last year. So I'm wondering if it makes sense to look into refinancing to get a better interest rate with the idea of having 20% down.
Well, it kind of comes back to you look at two things. Number one, look at the cost of refinancing. There's loan fees, there's appraisal fees and the like that's in there. And I'm just throwing out a figure of $3,000 for that cost. Then you look at how long are you going to live in the house. And if you're going to live in there a year or so, it probably doesn't make sense. But if you're going to be living there for 10 years, you may find that half a percent interest rate savings will amortize itself out and pay you back. I'm looking at the same thing. I've got a 4% interest rate, and I'm hearing at 3.5% going, ooh. So you sit down and you do the math.
Who helps you do the math?
Who helps her do the math?
Some of that you just kind of do yourself.
Uh-huh.
And there's online calculators that help with that.
Some,
absolutely.
Right.
Bankrate.com, I think, is one. It has an online calculator. Shows you what your mortgage payment would be.
And some of that, only you know how long you're going to be there.
That's the key.
All right. Now, I appreciate that. Let's do James here in Seattle. James, you're sort of looking at a similar idea to Christy.
Yeah. I was just wondering, on average, what I'd have to put down on a $160,000 house at the current interest rates to keep my payments under $1,000 a month.
Well, it comes back to how expensive is the house. So you're looking to buy one, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the good news in Pierce County is that the values are less. What I would do is I would go sit down with a bank and get pre-qualified, it's called. And you just said, look, here's what I want to do. I want to put down 5 or 10%. Here's where I want to keep my payments. They'll calculate for you and say you will be qualified to buy X
in the way of a house. I'd like to say something else about that. I think he needs to go see a housing counselor.
Yep, I like it.
And I think he needs to go get educated about the home buying process.
Yes, and you've got classes.
And we have classes.
Well, this is the key, right? This is
the State Housing Finance Commission.
I mean, are banks in welcoming everybody with open arms these days?
With good credit.
Yeah, if you're qualified.
With good credit.
And so then the key, though, is to figure it out before you go to somebody else's. You,
right. Go find out how much you qualify for. Go find out what your credit score is. Go find out if there are things on your credit report that can be taken off and your credit score raised.
So what would that be, though? If you're buying a house at $160,000 and you put 10% down, you're still going to spend more than $1,000 a month in your mortgage,
right?
Probably,
but
right?
Depending on what his credit score is, then that depends on what kind of interest rate you're going to
get. Right.
Because it'll be lower if you have a better credit score.
And he might qualify for some down payment assistance to help us offset some of that. We don't know. There's too many unknowns here to give a good answer.
But I'll tell you, he's coming from the right direction of what can I afford in the way of a house, as opposed to in the past, it's, well, I want that house for $1 million, and then they force themselves into it only to lose it later. So he's
so
at the right
I would
point.
Kind of work backwards. I would go, this is my gross income. Now, what is a third of my gross income? That is the amount of the payment that I can afford to pay.
Yep.
And the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle has a director of housing you, and so you have classes.
Yes, we do every third Saturday.
And how much do they cost?
Oh, they're free. They're free.
Come
free
on down.
Public. Come on down.
Let's
just
party.
So you just look it up on the
Saturday.
Web, you call in.
1-800-368-1455. And all of our classes will be now at the Miller Community Center.
Right there in the
19th Avenue East, every third Saturday from 10 until 3:30.
All right, here's another one. This is an email. We aren't under – well, I'm trying to refinance our house. We aren't underwater, but home value has decreased. We never missed a payment, have excellent credit rating. We have a loan from Chase, almost all assets there as well. So what kind of interest rate should we be looking for? Should we shop around? Shouldn't Chase be making it easy for us to do this? We owe $400,000 on the house.
Well, bottom line, that sounds like a HARP. Are you current? Have you ever missed a payment?
And no, she says no.
No. Well, you might be eligible for a HARP loan if, in fact, there is equity.
I see. They aren't underwater because the home value has decreased. Then there would be some. Who helps her with a HARP loan?
We can help that. We can help with that.
But Chase,
or you can go straight to the mortgage company and get that.
I see. But Chase wouldn't necessarily be doing that.
Yeah,
they will.
They
absolutely
might.
They will.
As the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, they just notified one of the people that works with me, and they said, hey, you qualify for this XYZ program, HARP in this case.
Uh-huh.
Come on down, we'll refinance you, get you a loan. So he was, dancing around the office. It was great.
Right.
So
I just had a banker call me and then say, have you heard of this program?
Yeah. And I had to do that with my bank, is I had to poke at him going, well, he got it.
Right.
You offer it at my bank. And we had to make three or four phone calls before someone went, oh, yeah. So you got to poke at them a little bit. But the housing classes would be a very good place to start.
Right. Housing classes really help you fill out those documents correctly.
I want to know why a banker didn't know about the HARP program. It's been around for like 4 years
already? No, it hasn't been around that long.
How long has it been around?
A couple years.
Too big to fail?
Yeah, this is part of the Obama.
They're too big.
I see.
Yeah, but it's just, just didn't know. He doesn't work in that department.
All right. Doesn't work in that department. All right. Jeff's in Seattle. Jeff, you're looking at an appraisal question here. Thanks for calling. You're on with Richard Hager and Linda Taylor. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I recently am doing a refi, and the appraisal came back, and instead of giving me a price as is or a value, there's a box that said subject to, and it's, repair some siding on a 70-year-old alleged garage that I use as a shed, and other painting requirements. This time of year in Seattle, I don't think that's a good idea. I was planning on painting this summer. Is there a way I can get this appraisal just as is and, pull $15,000 off the assessment? I only owe about a third to value on this thing, so that amount of money wouldn't bother me.
Well, it starts off with what kind of loan. It could be a VA FHA loan, in which case they have very stringent requirements. They want the house to be able to last for 15 to 30 years. So if there's moss on the roof, unpainted wood on the siding, that it is a condition of the loan to have those things repaired. And, so first of all, that's the most stringent. or if it's a what we'll call conventional, non-FHA VA, then those requirements are still there. They're just not quite as dramatic. But the appraiser is usually given a set of instructions by the bank, and it says, when you go out and inspect that, we want you to make it subject to anything you see that may be a problem, a rotted deck, a failed railing. Let's say it's a broken window. I mean, you know, it's gone. So the appraiser is often forced to make it subject to certain repairs before the bank will consider and make the loan. And again, it's usually fairly minor in this case. Yes, it's a pain in the rear end to go out there and paint it, but that's the best way. We also go around, we look for vents, and is dirt piled up against the side of the house. So you're kind of stuck with that. You could go to a different bank and try and hope it wouldn't be there, start it over. But
no, depending on what kind of appraisal it is, it's there.
Yeah, and there's a lot of bad appraisals out there. There's no question that
Getting better, because I think they're getting stricter, and frankly, they're just watching the appraisers. We're watching you, Richard.
Thank you.
Well, it sounded like we needed appraisers to be watched.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Because that's where some of the frauds you were talking about this few weeks ago.
All the stuff we were talking about West Sound. Mm-hmm. You know, every bad loan was backed by a bad appraisal.
Let me read you an email here, and thank you for that. So this is sort of stories we've heard in the past. How different is this situation today? This is from Shell. I have a house on Vashon. Bought in 2007, lived into 2010. They moved back to Seattle, couldn't sell the house, so they've hung on, making payments. She's had renters, but she has to cover the cost between the rent and the mortgage. Anyway, she wants to sell the house, but she's upside down on the house, even though she's current on the payments. And so what are her options to short sell without defaulting on the payments or to get a modification? House is worth about $550. She has two loans that total just under $600. So define short sale again. I don't know what a short sale is.
Well, a short sale is selling a house for less than the mortgage amount. If somebody's going to take it in the shorts, the bank, it's something a little bit less. But you know, two options, and let me give you one, and then Linda can give you some of the others. Option number one is real estate values have changed dramatically since March. It is absolutely astonishing to us at how fast they're starting to increase. So I would tell you that by June, July of this year, you may not be upside down. It may be something different. So one solution is simply waiting until the spring, if not the year after. So waiting may be an easiest solution. However, specific to that, Linda would have some other options that you could go over.
I would go for a loan modification. I would make sure that I had a very, very, very tight rental agreement, a lease, and just show the bank what you're getting for it, and make sure that those amounts of money are deposited into the bank.
You mean the rent?
The rent, right, because a lot of people collect it or trade it or do something else.
Go gambling with it.
Okay. And go for a loan modification. So they can only tell you no.
The bank sees your good faith.
Yes.
They see what you're working on.
Yes, they might work with that, depending on your investor, because they want to keep you. They don't want your home.
Again, classes.
Classes?
I mean, you may not understand some of these things. The bank may help you with it. They may not, depending on which mortgage officer you're getting.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, a lot of them will. Bank of America and Chase both have service centers here. I always suggest you go to a housing counselor first, because you don't want to lose your right to mediation while you're working with the bank.
You know, we got this email from Corey. Please pass on to callers when looking for a good mortgage. Check out the local credit unions, BECU, Solal. Their rates are good and fees way lower. Do you find that as well, that the credit unions?
I do.
I do, too.
And is it, again, a question of being a member?
No, they have new rules.
Yeah,
their rules you have to live within a school district in the state of Washington.
I think that covers everything.
Now, here's a question I have. Scott has sent this question, and we got an email, too, once we started getting involved in the mortgage business again. What do you think of biweekly payment programs, and how do you find reputable companies? What are these biweekly programs? They sort of pretend, well, they seem to offer you a way to save money.
Well, you just make your payment every other week.
But the bank would be happy with you.
Well, the bank would be happy, but remember, that's what you have to do, make your payment. And don't you save a payment I think you save two payments a year.
Absolutely. And so you can go get yourself your own 30-year fixed-rate mortgage,
right,
and then you on your own can simply make a payment every two weeks. So that's one solution. Or you put it into a bank account so that it's automatically withdrawn, however you want to play with it.
Well, a lot of the computers won't take that.
Right.
Because they'll hold it in a escrow account and then still post it once a month. You're making your payment biweekly, but they only post once a month.
Now, you can ask banks. Some banks will do that, but you got to ask around for it. Now, then there's the other side. There are some companies that say they're going to insert themselves and do this. I wouldn't trust those.
Oh, you'd have to pay, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's in the ones that I have seen. Again, I'm sure there's a legitimate one out there somewhere, but the ones that we have seen that said, we'll hold your money for you, that's all they're doing is they're holding your money.
Yeah,
holding you money. Yeah. So ask the bank. Ask the bank.
Ask the bank. All right, last question here. There are a lot of questions, but I got one time for one more. David's in Gig Harbor. David, you have good credit, but getting loan is hard. Why?
Yeah, you know, we had excellent credit, and I should preface this by saying we did end up getting the loan and getting the house, but it left such an impression on us in the sense that the things they made us do with really good credit, and I might add very little outstanding debt. All of our cars were paid off, you know, no credit card debt. So we really felt we were excellent. And they made my wife produce the bizarrest things. They made my wife produce a transcript to prove that she had actually just graduated from her graduate program at UW-Tacoma. She made the loan officer required us to
Well, here, let me get an answer on this because I'm going to run out of time. But this is the hoops you were talking about when we started this.
Right.
Any way to avoid it, or is this just where we live today?
Did she have a job? Or did she just graduate?
Yeah, that's possible.
And had potential earnings.
I see. But, so they want to know all sorts of things.
Right.
I would have asked
that question, too. I mean, do you have a job or just potential earnings that we're going
through? And that's a paranoia. We've had this pendulum swing. It used to be easy credit. We'll give it to anybody who's breathing, has got a pulse.
Right.
You know, and now it's like, oh, man, we're getting smacked around. So the banks are overly paranoid. They want to make sure things
are. I think they're lightening up just a little bit. But
the pendulum
depending on when you got it and what mortgage company you actually went to, you know, if they were in deep trouble, hey.
Well, the upswing is here, so we better have you guys back again because folks had a lot of questions.
He got a mortgage.
He did get a mortgage in the end. Linda Taylor is Housing Director at the Urban League. Richard Hager is a real estate agent and appraiser. Classes at the Urban League, 1-800-368-1455. And you can find links at KOW as well. Thank you both.
Thank you.
KOW 946. Seattle Repertory Theater is celebrating the creativity of playwrights. KUOW's Marcy Silman tells us how in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle.
Wikipedia relies on humans to write all of those entries, you know. A whole lot of human men, as it turns out.
And so I understand how we got here. I understand why so many Wikipedia editors are male. But it's not good for the encyclopedia.
Ladies, Wikipedia is looking at you. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll have a chat with the boss of the Wikimedia Foundation next time on Marketplace from APN.
That's tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, an independently owned wealth advisor committed to balancing clients' financial well-being with their personal fulfillment, providing customized financial planning, investment strategy, and trust management services. On the web at LairdNortonWM.com.
47 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 50. It's cloudy now. Forecast says rain is likely through the day. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:48. The Seattle Police Department now has automatic license plate recognition technology in some of its cruisers. What exactly is it? How does it work? And should you care? That's 20 minutes away.
But first, new work, the lifeblood of any arts organization, and Marcy Silman is part of Art of Our City, new work at Seattle Rep.
That's true, Steve. Rep is known through its 50-year history for, in the past at least, generating a lot of new plays that went on to Broadway under Dan Sullivan. And one of the things that current artistic director Jerry Manning wanted to do was sort of revive that part of the rep's past. And so they're in the midst of a new play festival. And I asked Jerry Manning to come in, and he brought with him the Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Robert Schenken, who's
just for fun.
And Robert Schenken, you may know his work from a whole lot of places, but he won a Pulitzer Prize 20 years ago for The Kentucky Cycle, which premiered at Intiman. And so he's got a new play. And they both came into the studios, and I wanted to know why we were having a festival at the rep.
3 or 4 years ago, we sort of redoubled our efforts in terms of making new work, particularly doubling, tripling the number of commissions we have. And this is an opportunity for us to see some of those commissions, to share it with our audiences, and hopefully to help them finish the process of writing the play so that we can produce them.
But this is the first official festival where you've put them all together and are showing them to people.
That's true. We thought, why not conjoin the reading so that people begin to think of Seattle Rep in terms of making new work? If you spread it out, the message is diffused, I think. It also helps us this time of year, just in terms of our own planning, as we're budgeting for next season and the season after.
Helps you because you get to see them.
Exactly.
I see. You mentioned people start thinking, conjoining the idea of the rep and new work, but that's not something that the rep, that's new to the rep.
I would say we're revisiting it. I do think that in the time, for instance, of Dan Sullivan, there was quite a bit of new work going on. And Dan and Doug Hughes in particular inaugurated something similar, a new play festival. All kinds of amazing writers were out here in the 80s, early 90s. When Dan left, that sort of withered away. Selective new plays were done here and there, but as a focus, as a fulcrum for planning work, we thought we'd revisit it.
Robert Schenken, playwright, the festival kicked off with readings of two plays, one of which has had a full production, the other, I think, not yet. Am I correct?
That's correct. The first play is called All the Way. And it was commissioned by the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as part of their American Revolutions project and was produced this summer, directed by Bill Rausch. It is about the first term, LBJ's first term, November 63 to November 64, and what I think of as kind of a hinge point, really, in American politics. Their commission is very wide open. It was anything to do with American history. But I knew very quickly that I'd been thinking about LBJ and writing something about the presidency for a long time. And the question was then, well, what specifically? There's so much material. You could pick a place almost anywhere. Rather than try to do both terms, I determined pretty quickly that I would focus on this one year, this one extraordinary year. And if I was fortunate enough that some well-intentioned theater saw the possibility of a second play, then I would pursue the story. And I'm very fortunate and pleased to say that Seattle Repertory Theater has done just that. They've commissioned the second play, which is called The Great Society, and picks up in November 64 and carries through to his startling revelation on national television in March 1968 that he will not run for re-election.
So I'm assuming, Jerry Manning, that you saw the first play and thus commissioned the second, or are you taking it on faith that Robert Schenken's going to deliver something good?
Well, I did see the production at OSF of All the Way, which I loved. I just loved it. But Robert and I and Brayden Abraham have been talking for, I don't know, 3 years. Wow. Robert, is that case? Mm-hmm. And I believe, sometimes I get chronology wrong, but I believe we commissioned The Great Society even in advance of the full production. Am I right about that?
I think that's true, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I would assume for you, a playwright of your experience and stature, that maybe it's easier for you to get a theater to either commission or produce a work. And I'm wondering, you know, where you stand vis-a-vis some of the writers in this Seattle Rep New Play Festival. Why is it important for them to have a festival as opposed to just writing and making contacts?
I think it's critical to raise the awareness of what we're trying to do in terms of new work. There's a lovely range of experience among the writers they've selected for this. it's a useful part of the process of development as a writer to be able to get in a room with some really talented actors. And Seattle, of course, is so fortunate in the community of actors that we have here. To get in a room with those actors and hear the work, just hearing it is useful, whether you hear it in front of an audience or not, but to hear the work. Well, when I wrote Kentucky Cycle, which was a six-hour, two-part epic event, I wrote it with the entire structure in mind, so from beginning to end. In this instance, this is a slightly different approach. I've written the first, what will become the first half, and I certainly had some notion of what a second half might be, but I didn't write it in the same way all at the same time. So now I'm approaching this second part. I've learned certain things. I've also established certain things, certain parameters. And so it was extremely useful what Jerry and Seattle Repertory Theater gave me, the opportunity to hear a reading of All the Way and then immediately the next day to have read out loud, and we wound up reading it three times, what I've created thus far, which is the first act of The Great Society.
For folks who've never been to a play reading, what might we expect that's different than a full-on production?
Basically, a reading would not include scenic elements, maybe a very basic light plot, minimal costume, if that. And also, it means the actors are not off book. They have not committed the script to memory. So what you get then is syllable by syllable, a trip through the play or where it is at that point. So it's a stripped-down version of a full production, and you have the, I would call it the benefit of having an unfinished script here where the writer is working right now, and to, as an audience member, begin to imagine what it might become. I think for Seattle Rep, and Robert mentioned this when we were doing the readings of All the Way in the Great Society a couple weeks back, to invite our patrons into a reading is an incredible opportunity to educate our audiences about new work and why it's important and to bring people inside the building. I think it's that simple.
You know, it seems to me that there are maybe more theater artists than ever working on little projects here and there in the city of Seattle. And I've heard a lot of the theaters, the ACT also has had readings. There's artists who are organizing their own series so that they can make work. And is it my imagination, Robert and Jerry, or is it true that despite the money problems that we've been seeing, that things really are flourishing, at least artistically?
I think so, definitely. That's my experience. It certainly is a struggle financially. I don't want to underplay that. But I do have this energy in Seattle and actually nationally. I think this is a really extraordinary time of theatrical writing. There's so many really compelling writers out there across the country. And Seattle, which has historically been a hotbed of theatrical activity and had a profound effect disproportionate to its size to the national theater scene, I think is experiencing a similar kind of resurgence. It's what you mentioned, actors and writers creating their own events as opposed to waiting to be produced, which I think is a particularly healthy trend. And I'm seeing a lot of that, and I think it's great.
That's playwright, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Schenken, one of the writers who are involved in the Seattle Rep's new play festival. The festival runs through this weekend at the Bagley Wright Theater at Seattle Center. Schenken and Jerry Manning talked to Marcy Silman, who's still here.
I am still here.
Because you are working on, you and the Seattle Times.
Sort of like that.
Are working on a year-long series, 13 in 2013.
13 for 13. It's a series of monthly profiles of people who are in mid-career in the culture span who have made an impact and are going to continue to make an impact on our cultural landscape. We started last month with Yoko Ott. And this month, I'm profiling for the Seattle Times, not for KUOW, two arts administrators who are really shaking things up. Andy Fife, who is the executive director of Shunpike. You might know them from Storefront Seattle. And Randy Engstrom, who's the interim director of the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs. And I went to talk to him early last year, an interview that ran on weekdays, part of Art of Our City, and I asked him what the work of his office should really be.
Whether that's about public safety or downtown revitalization or education or jobs, I think that arts and culture should be at the table for all those decisions, not because it's like a charitable act to let arts in the room, but because we can bring so much to bear to help those issues. I think that arts and culture is a strategy and a resource, not just something that we need to fund because it's nice to have.
Well, that's Randy Engstrom. The full city council is going to consider his interim appointment, making it permanent in March. But you can read more about them on Sunday in the Seattle Times, and you can find a link to this interview at our website.
KUOW.org. Thanks, Marcy.
And now, the sound of the day.
One last sound from the road. Bicycle correspondent Willie Weir biking through Cambodia with his wife. He says when he first heard this sound, he thought it was a recording meant to keep birds out of buildings. Then he found out the real story. It's a recording meant to encourage birds to nest on a building because they want bird's nest soup, an expensive delicacy in China made from the nest of a couple of species of swifts that nest in caves and cliffs, and their nest is used as the basis for the soup. They're hard to come by. They go for as much as $1,500 a kilogram, and so people try to attract them. By the way, Willie said every time he recorded something anywhere on this trip, a motorcycle was in that recording. There it was again.
I think I heard one.
Yep. Stay with us.
10 a.m. Consumer spending is up slightly. How much and what does it mean? We'll find.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.